Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Rich Muni, Vice President for the Poker Players Alliance. A mechanical engineer by profession, Rich has been on the board of directors at PPA for 10 years. He was a guest on this program in October 2013, in case you wish to check out the earlier interview. Rich Muni, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks, Bob and Richard. Appreciate having me. It's terrific to be here in person this time. Last time I called in, and nice to be in town and get to meet you face-to-face.
Yeah, you look different when we see you than when you're on the telephone.
So I imagine. That's probably a good thing.
Please remind us what the Poker Players Alliance is all about.
Well, PPA is standing up for the right to play. We stand up against those who would ban us, which is more at the federal level now, because some people in Congress would like to ban us, led by a multi-billion dollar donor to that effort, Sheldon Adelson. And at the state level, we're generally on offense, pushing forward. So if you like online poker, if you just like the game of poker and know that you need new players coming in to preserve the ecosystem, you need to support PPA.
So does the PPA have lobbyists?
In the past, the PPA has always had lobbyists. Finally, industry is taking more control over that. They should be the ones lobbying, and we should be out there just making sure we have lobbyists in place to advocate for player stuff. And John Pappas, our executive director, is a registered lobbyist. And not only does he lobby by himself, but he also interfaces with a lot of industry lobbyists to ensure that they understand what the players need.
You mentioned Sheldon Adelson. He's owner of major casinos in Vegas and Macau, and he's been against online gaming and willing to put his money where his mouth is. How does that make your life more interesting?
It's interesting in a number of ways. Obviously, it complicates it when somebody's funding a multi-million dollar effort against you. And not only that, he doesn't actually have to spend the money. He lobbies and donates on so many other things. Sometimes just a phone call from him means what it would take someone else to come up with a multi-million dollar lobbying effort just because of his past efforts. And it can be pretty painful. So there's pros and cons. I want to go through the con real quick. And he's playing from the 1980s playbook, clearly. He thinks he's just supposed to lobby lobbyists, lobby congressmen and senators directly, kind of tries to interfere with their reelection runs, tries to once in a while intimidate somebody by talking about funding a primary challenger, but doesn't really understand social media. He's outspent us by, huge factors, but we still have 100% dominance of social media. It's not even close. Most of the people who write to Congress on this matter are writing in favor of our position. He's really not able to secure the activism base, doesn't even understand the social media base. One thing we try to do is really strategize this. So I look at this really strategically, just go through everything he's doing step by step. Where can we counter? Because I can't counter him dollar for dollar. And if I told my membership we're going to counter him dollar for dollar, they'd look at me like I was nuts and just decide we lost in advance. So that's what he's done. Now, what everybody needs to understand is he does understand the political game. So when something's at the state level and it's super close, it's like 51% to 49%, his lobbyists can find those fault lines between the various coalitions that came together to pass something, and he can try to put a little split in there. And that's where he can cause some trouble. So we have to stay that much stronger. And that's why it's important to stay behind PPA. These lawmakers need to hear from the players, and they need to understand this is where the people want to go on this issue.
Yeah, I can't see the majority of people in the states that don't have it, this being an issue that they care about. If they don't play poker, I can't see them getting fired up about this issue and writing their congressman the way they would about a much more incendiary topic like guns or abortion or something like that.
It tends to be interesting on this, Richard. We do have, like you said, throughout this, it's been like 90% of the people don't care. Some percentage of the people are for it. Some people are against it. And it's always been like that. So we try to play up the bigger issues of internet freedom, liberty to do what you want in your own home, opposition to crony capitalism, the rights of states to make their decisions. We can tell a lot of Republican lawmakers that they're weakening the power of the states when they support the idea that the federal government should shut down state-licensed online poker, and that does resonate very well with many, not all.
should certainly resonate with Rand Paul. Does he support you guys?
Well, Rand Paul's my senator because I do live in Kentucky, and he's been very supportive of this. My congressman, Thomas Massey, is a little bit even better on it because he's very specific on the right that states should be allowed to make their decisions on this. So he's pretty much going to put the kibosh on a lot of federal efforts to push through a ban, which is Sheldon Adelson's focus largely right now.
Is there a constitutional right to be able to play poker in your underwear? I'm just wondering.
Unfortunately, it does not address that. I'm sure we could propose a constitutional amendment, but I think that would be a challenge right now.
That sounds like a challenge indeed. All right. How is online poker today different in the United States than it was last time you were on 3.5 years ago?
It's an interesting question. Right after Black Friday, which was 6 years ago, it was a September of 2011, and pardon me, it was April 15th, 2011. And what we saw was immediately a lot more activism. And some people come to me and say, well, isn't this kind of a good thing in that we have so many people who realize what happened and now they're willing to fight now that they can't just play full tilt and poker stars from their home anymore? And I told them, well, no, first of all, not at all. But even in the abstract, it's not even good for the short term, because you know, people are going to start dropping off once they're not playing. They're going to move on with their lives. And that is one thing we've seen. So that started at that time when I was on your program last time. We started seeing the effects of just people who had moved on from the game. And we're still seeing that. But at the same time, we're seeing three states who have been dealing online poker, and two of them have online casino-style gaming, and a few others have some online lottery products. And a couple of states are moving forward now. So we're starting to see a lot of good activism. I think Sheldon Adelson might be the biggest thing since the last time I was on, because he had just kind of started hinting at what he wanted to do. 2014 was his focus. And that's really kind of fired people up, that this, you know, billionaire wants to take your right away. He's got so much, but he concerns himself with what you do in your underwear, how you play, Bob, or how the rest of us play, in the comfort of our own home. That he just says to him, you know, he wants to reach into your home. I mean, I think that's incendiary. You already have, who's practically an oligarch trying to direct, you know, how Congress operates, wants to get that deep into your life. I think it struck a lot of people wrong.
Yeah, it does seem an odd strategy for him, too, because you would think he would just go the opposite way and say, well, rather than fighting them, I'll just join them and make more money once we get it passed. You know, because I think in his mind he's keeping those gambling dollars for his casinos instead of, you know, the online poker sites. But he could just own the online poker sites and fight the other side of the issue.
You know, Richard, this is where it gets weird. Like, if regular folks like me, and I guess all of us, you know, if I earn like $500,000 doing something, I'd be dancing in the streets, woohoo, I just picked up $500,000. Even if a competitor of mine picked up $2 million, I would think I picked up $500,000. I'd be pretty happy. Sheldon Adelson would look at that and think he lost $1.5 million because his competitor out-earned him. When it comes to online poker, he's probably going to be like a third-tier player. It's going to be hard for him to, and he knows that because he's a smart businessman. He doesn't just dream that he's going to be number one. He's looking at what Caesars has going and what potentially MGM could do, where Amaya is in the industry now. And he said, well, I'm not going to be an industry leader. This isn't going to be a good thing for me, even if I make some money on it. I think that played into part of his initial decision. And from there, I think once he started thinking it wasn't be good for him, I think confirmation bias kind of took over a little bit. And then he starts kind of looking at the industry through kind of jaded lens. And he starts thinking, well, you know, this could be problematic here. This could be a problem there. And a lot of times it's easy for us to do when we already have a preconceived notion. So I think it's a combination that he doesn't think it's going to be good for his business has kind of parlayed across the board. Now it's become something of an obsession for him because the money he's spending is certainly not going to benefit his corporation. But somehow his stockholders don't seem to be complaining about it.
So we've had online poker in these three states for a few years now. How has it done?
It's, you know, it's been an incredibly successful venture from a regulatory standpoint. There hasn't been a single problem. All of the opponents of the game, they keep trying to bring up hypotheticals. They say, well, what if this, what if that? They never bring any data from the three states that offer licensed gaming. It's almost bizarre. It's almost like they're admitting there's no problem with this. So we try to remind lawmakers to say, hey, start asking them you know, if they say all these problems are going to happen, ask them show the data from New Jersey showing that any of these problems have even started. They've done a tremendous job on the financials. I think we just need more liquidity. I mean, they offer good games.
No, but I mean, how is it done? I mean, has the player base continued to grow?
That's what I'm kind of getting at. How is it doing in terms of the game? The liquidity is the main problem. I mean, like if you want to play online blackjack or online slots, the provider doesn't really care how many players there are. If the player base increases by 10 times, the operator profit probably increases by tenfold. Poker has a liquidity issue where we need more players to have more games, and they go up exponentially. Like, for example, 8 people can't even will get one shorthanded table going, assuming they all agree on the game. 800 people have huge varieties of games, and people waiting in line because the game they want to play is being dealt right then. And the same thing happens online. If someone shows up 3 in the morning or even 11 in the morning when people are at work and they don't see their game, then they just go away. This is the main thing. This is why we want interstate compacting. So we have it now with Nevada and Delaware, but we need to kind of expand that out. But people enjoy playing. It's kind of run flat. iGaming has been increasing, which is, you know, the online slot machines and online casino style gaming, which has been a good thing for poker because it keeps the drive to bring it into different states alive because the financials are there. So we've actually been pretty pleased with the overall performance. In New Jersey, the total package of online poker and online gaming has resulted in increases in the bricks and mortar revenue. So all gaming has gone up, but also the bricks and mortar by itself has gone up. It's been a complementary offering.
Why was Nevada able to make a compact with Delaware, but not with New Jersey?
Well, they can make a compact in New Jersey if New Jersey wishes to. They're kind of, you know, since New Jersey was second in the nation in the modern gaming era, Nevada, of course, really never gave it up. They're technically illegal, but there were a bunch of games in 1933-ish. They started licensing. Atlantic City came in around 1977-ish.
Well, they had their own illegal games in Atlantic City.
We have illegal games all along the Ohio River and Kentucky, too. But in terms of the legal market, these were kind of the two poles. They kind of saw themselves, kind of the competitors. And that competition kind of goes through to today. I think New Jersey, they have a very strong gaming commission. I think they think they, and they're correct about that, that they could regulate for a number of states. They'd probably like to get some interstate compacting with some other states in their region. I think Nevada, with the smaller population, they also want to compact with more states. That was the whole reason they passed it. They wanted to be first in the nation to pass online poker legislation, and they would like to also bring in some more states under their regulatory authority. So I think these two states might be the last two to combine forces.
No, I would expect to combine with New Jersey before Utah. But
I don't think there's a combination because Utah doesn't have a gaming commission yet.
Yeah.
That might be a while off.
But New Jersey and Atlantic City is failing. Las Vegas is thriving. I would think New Jersey would want to hook up with something that is thriving.
Well, but their online gaming is not failing, right?
The New Jersey online game is better than is surpassing the Nevada one, but Nevada is poker only. And then there are some sports betting things. It's kind of different, but in terms of this specific iGaming genre, they kind of went with poker only. And now I know they have apps where you can play just within the hotel. And interestingly, Venetian offers it. Venetian offers an online sports betting app where you can bet anywhere in Nevada. So Nevada's got some kind of divided up offerings, but the ones that are regulated, it's poker only. New Jersey offers online gaming too, so there's more revenue coming to the state. You know, their gaming industry suffered a lot about 7 or 8 years ago with the recession that hit this state hard as well. But they did bounce back. Their revenues are coming back up. They're not where they were 8 years ago. But all the individual casino revenues are improving, and the iGaming revenue is going up as well. So failing isn't really a white word because they have turned it around, but they're not where they were.
Yeah, well, they have
iGaming been, iGaming is as high as it's been.
Yeah, right. And they keep bragging about that in an effort to pass legal sports betting, which they're working really hard to do.
They're working very hard. I think that's going to benefit the state of New Jersey a lot if they can get that done. I think, interestingly, And I'm glad you brought this point up, because when it comes to what we've been doing at poker, it started opening up a lot of lawmakers' eyes to the rights of states to make their own decisions. And it makes sense. You start talking about sports betting, like, well, you know, Nevada can have it 100%. Three other states can kind of have parts of it, whatever they had before PASPA passed in 1992, and then the grandfathering period a year later. Why shouldn't these states be allowed to at least do what Nevada does today? Should Congress protect a monopoly for sports betting for this state and not allow New Jersey to go forward? So there's going to be a pretty big push from a number of states, and New Jersey's pretty much leading the charge on that right now.
Is the Poker Players Alliance involved in us helping online sports betting at all, or is this you're just speaking as an individual? An ordinary guy, I think we phrased it.
Well, in this case, I'm just giving I'm just kind of trying to state objectively the way I see it. From PPA, we're not involved in online sports betting or bricks and mortar sports betting, but I do think anytime gaming gains more acceptance, I think it's good for poker. We've seen that across the board. Imagine trying to fight this online poker fight 40 years ago. People would just think we're insane, or even 50 years ago, like, or before my time, but imagine
before computers.
Well, but even if you just look at California, just trying to get hold'em in California. When I first moved to California, precisely, you couldn't play hold'em. It was, you know, draw poker. And
But in some of the research I've done, I was reading when the, because I was mentioned specifically 50 years ago, when New Hampshire adopted the lottery. I mean, there are editorials saying this is, you know, thank you, lawmakers, for paving the road to hell for our citizens. I mean, they're dead serious that this was just the worst thing you could imagine for citizenship, for good citizenship, and for the nation as a whole. That would be a pretty tough, and would you say online poker would be possible? You could probably have a dial-in service even with the technology of the era. Certainly into the 70s, you could have some really weak dial-in technology to a dedicated type of a bulletin board service. What's really changed isn't so much the technology, but the way people think about the game and think about your right to play. Gaming has gained so much acceptance, and I think the more you would see all these other games gain acceptance, I think it's going to do a lot for poker, because we're usually kind of... We've heard lawmakers suggest that we're kind of like beer and wine, and they're like spirits, you know, like for sports betting, blackjack, and those types of games. So when they're in, it's hard to say, well, I'm okay with, you know, roulette, but not poker. We just don't hear that.
Yeah, it seems to me the easiest sell, right? Because they see it on TV all the time. And then once people start doing it, the other states see how much money the revenue is bringing in.
Precisely.
And suddenly they're like, why don't we have that? And, yeah, I think, yeah, this will all slide across the country over the next 10 years or so, and everybody will have it the way everybody has casinos now. There'll be a few holdouts like Utah and Alabama and stuff like that.
Oh, Alabama has casinos. Utah doesn't, and Hawaii doesn't, but Alabama does.
Yeah, but Alabama's fighting it, and I mean, they have whatever, but you know what I'm saying.
Interestingly, you can find an underground poker game in Alabama pretty easily. I have no idea how it would go in Utah. I'm sure you could hunt down
something.
You
think you could find some Texas Hold'em in Texas where they have no casinos and poker is illegal? I mean, that's pretty crazy that Texas doesn't have any gambling.
I think I could find a pretty good game of poker while I'm in Texas. And there is one casino in Texas, and they keep trying to shut that down.
Other than online poker, what else is PPA involved in?
We're involved in poker and poker only. We like to say we don't even have an opinion on motherhood and apple pie. You know, if you ask us for we have no stance on either one. We have a stance on poker, but we do recognize the environment in which we are operating in. So, in terms of the money we can spend, most of it has to go to online because that's where the fight is. It's hard to spend a lot of money at the bricks and mortar level, especially when the operators and people who are trying to bring it in the game are the ones who should be spending the money there. If somebody comes to PPA like Maryland did a few years ago, then we're there. And we actually did push, it's called Question 7, and we're able to push that through. It went through like with a 52 to 48. So obviously a lot of different people can take credit for 2 or 3%, but we came in toward the end. So we're probably right there in terms of taking credit. But the online game is where we are. Online poker. Now, when it comes to online slot machines and stuff, we're usually kind of paired up with those bills. And we don't really separate ourselves out. Like we said, we only support the online poker part of this bill. We support the whole bill. We kind of used to be trying to separate it out a little bit more, but you recognize where the industry is going, where we need to be a part of. And we don't want providers of those to think we're not supportive of the whole bill either. We don't want lawmakers to think, oh, there's something wrong with the online gaming part, and therefore they hold up the whole bill. So we are, we're supportive when poker is involved.
Do you coordinate at all with the AGA?
We have talked to them in the past a lot on various things. Now, since Sheldon Adelson has pulled back from the online gaming, online poker part of it, the AGA had to follow suit because they're a trade organization. And I've had people come to me and say, how come they're so gutless and weak? And I say, well, it doesn't work that way. They're a membership group. They have various industries who make up the trade organization. They kind of have to agree, and then they move forward on those things on which they agree. Right now, there's just nothing to coordinate with them on because they're not doing any. They're kind of neutral on the online gaming issue.
But
it's easier to talk to their component companies like Caesars and MGM.
But they're neutral on that. But I think they're in favor of Motherhood and Apple Pie. I'm pretty sure.
I didn't see any apple pie last time I was.
All right. At the speaking of membership, if one wanted to become a member of PPA, how would one go about that?
Well, everyone should just, and thanks, Bob. I think everybody should join. Everyone should just go to theppa.org. There's a donate button at the top, and it's directly at theppa.org/donate. Just chip in a couple of big bets to help contribute to the fight we have going. You can sign up for a newsletter right there, and there's just a ton of information. So be sure to join us up. Follow us on social media as well. On Twitter, we're at PPA Poker, and facebook.com/theppa.
World Series of Poker in Las Vegas just ended. Saw the return of Chris Ferguson. Chris was a popular player before Full Tilt collapse, and then pretty much became a persona non grata, although not as much as Howard Lederer. Under the new scoring rules, Ferguson won the Player of the Year at this summer's World Series of Poker, and depending how the World Series of Poker in Europe goes in November, he may well be the overall Player of the Year. You speak to players all over the country. How much are they grumbling about this?
Oh, players are not happy. Nobody is happy about this situation. When it comes to me, I mean, I don't like to change rules midstream. So if somebody published rules for something, I'm usually not that one who just kind of looks at how it's going and then tries to change the rules to suit the desired outcome. But I don't think he's going to get a lot of praise if he does win this one. It's not going to be like any other player who won it. The whole situation is very unfortunate there.
So he's winning because they changed the rules. In which way?
No. What I'm saying is once you start seeing that he might win Player of the Year, even though players are grumbling, I haven't heard anybody say that the rules should be changed so he can't win Player of the Year. I mean, the rules are the rules, and I believe in objectivity, and it would just be difficult to try to change midstream to try to make sure he can't win the award. But I don't think anybody's going to give him much respect for winning it.
Because
of his past history.
Because they don't give him any respect anyway.
Because there's so much anger over Black Friday that I just don't think people are going to look at his victory. And they'll recognize he's a good poker player, but nobody ever thought he wasn't. But it's going to just be hard for people to kind of come up and support. At the same time, I think Chris has tried to adopt the anti-hero attitude when you see him at the tables. He always had the black hat anyway, but now he's kind of literally adopted that. And I think he wants to be the bad boy of poker, but in reality, what else can he be?
At the Aria, this September, they have a Purple Jacket series of 5 high roller events. For 4 of them, the entry fees are $50,000, with 1 rebuy allowed. And for the final one, it's $100,000 with no rebuy allowed. Dress code, a business casual with no headphones and no sunglasses will be enforced. You'll be limited to 30 seconds per decision, although up to 3 times a day you can have an extra 60 seconds. But no going into the tank. The overall winner, in addition to a lot of money, earns a purple jacket. Gut feeling. Do you think this is something that will take off and be good for poker?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I support you know, their right to offer any game they want to. I think it's kind of important to have different varieties. That's why there's so many different kinds of poker. I mean, how many varieties of the game are there? And then, you know, there are three main categories. There's like limit, no limit, tournament. And then within those categories, there are just a ton of different variants of poker. So why not have one where people play a little bit faster, dress a little nicer, and try to have a different attitude? Have some others that are ladies only, and you have some that maybe somebody will choose to offer a men's only to compete with the ladies only. I don't know if anyone's going to bother with it, but, you know, people are entitled to try to set up their own tournaments. I know in this state, you wouldn't be able to exclude anybody from the games based on gender. So you could just kind of establish your desired people to attend. I think it'll be interesting to watch. I know there are a lot of people out there who do complain that poker players could dress nicer, and some others who think, you know, they should be as casual as they want to be and see how the market responds and watch and see if that takes off. It'll be interesting to see from a skill perspective how not wearing sunglasses and watching having the shorter amount of time to make these decisions will go into play. I think from a spectator standpoint, the faster game will be a lot more appealing. Other sports are trying it too, like chess. There's been a movement to get these, you know, chess games going a lot more faster. Unfortunately, sometimes you don't have to delay so much. You're just trying to put on a show to convince your opponent of something. Chess does the same thing as well as poker. And if it's not necessary, and if you put in that clock for everybody, it actually doesn't change the game all that much in terms of playing it. But from a spectator point of view, it makes it much more enjoyable. And at the end of the day, if you're playing tournament poker and you're looking for spectators, you want to have a spectator-friendly game.
Are these ARIA tournaments going to be televised is my first question. I like the no sunglasses rule, and I like the time limit rule. I mean, I think those are great for poker. And I also think if these are televised, it will be really good for poker because people are going to see faces they recognize. I mean, because if you can afford a $50,000 buy-in or a $100,000 buy-in, they're going to be... The majority of the people in those tournaments are going to be faces that we've all seen before. So I think that's good for poker. And I thought it was interesting in the final table of this year's World Series. I happened to be, you know, looking at Twitter at the same time, and they were really giving a lot of flack to, I think it was Salas was his name, who, you know, he would go, there'd be a raise in front of him, and he'd go into the tank with, you know, 9-3 offsuit, you know, and people were, in fact, I think Daniel Negreanu actually said, I hope this guy is the next one out because, you know, this is not fun to watch. So.
Absolutely.
But yeah, he was a little bit slower, but compared to past years, nobody at the final table was really, really slow.
Yeah. I suspect that people were talked to about that.
And it definitely makes sense. Now, it's weird. A lot of us came up through the online game. I have probably millions of hands online up until Black Friday shut that down. And, you know, we play fast because you have to. There's a timer on the online game. And it's funny. These same players can somehow manage to four table, six table, get all their decisions in plenty of time. And yet at the table, somehow they have to take, you know, 10 minutes to make, not 10 minutes, but take quite a while to make some of these decisions. And we don't wear glasses playing online much, sunglasses playing much online either. You can, but it makes it hard to see the screen.
I guess it would. So, you used to play online poker. Do you still play poker?
I don't get to play as much, to be honest. I just find the bricks and mortar game, because I was focused mostly on limit poker, and there's just not as much return in that in the local games, because you only play one hand at a time. But I am trying to play more just to keep the skill set up, but I am definitely looking forward to getting the online game back. I just enjoy being able to get it. My specialty is shorthanded, no limit, maybe, you know, 10-20, between 5-10, 10-20, and sometimes 20-40, depending on the opposition. And I generally like to four table. So each table might get 100 hands an hour, so you might be able to get 400 hands an hour. So you can turn a decent return playing it. And if I'm looking purely at my expected return, which is what you should be doing if you're trying to make money at the game, you know, and you get like 22 hands an hour at a, you know, at the bricks and mortar table, it could be kind of slow going. But so I think of it more as just for entertainment. But I am trying to pick up the no limit game a little bit better.
So I think you misspoke. You said your specialty was shorthanded no limit. Did no, you short, mean shorthanded short, limit?
No, shorthanded limit.
Limit. Okay.
Limit poker. Yeah. Yeah, I think if we're playing more no limit, it might be easier to go to some of these local games and try to get a better return out of it. But for the limit game, it just makes it a challenge because the no limit game is so much more popular, for one. People see it on TV. They just love that all-in move. And then you go to the local casino and you try, as you know, it's easier here in Vegas. I can go to Bellagio and get any game I want at limit. But, yeah, it's kind of northern Kentucky, southern Indiana, southern Ohio, it's just hard to find, you know, a relatively decent game. If you do find it, you don't see a lot of tourists coming in to it. So it becomes, in terms of trying to get a good win rate out of it, it could be a little more challenging. It seems like the, yeah, it's definitely the limit game is where you start seeing more people. Now, I do think the limit game is problematic. We have a problem because we can take too much money from these new players. They come in, they watch on TV, they think it'll be fun because they played with their buddies a little bit, and then they're like losing every hand when they push all in because they think fourth, fifth hand is going to be the winner because they're thinking of all the possibilities, but not thinking nobody's going to call with anything lower than that. And I think that's somehow can create some problems in the game itself because they lose too fast, and then, of course, that makes it hard to retain an interest in the game. At limit, you go when by its very name, you're limited by the amount of money you can lose. So you might have kind of an off night one night, do a little bit better the next night. The money comes out of the recreational players at a much slower rate, and I think it's better for the ecology of the game. But
the problem with limit now is that it's solved. So especially if you're playing online,
heads up limit is solved.
Heads up limit is solved, but these are solved from game theory aspects. So you still have to be playing a bot, and if you're playing bricks and mortar, you're not running into this problem.
No,
first of all, unless you're looking at their iPhone just a little bit too much, or some other device. And then, like you said, it's heads up, but you have to be heads up for First Streets. So you kind of have to get into a limit hold'em game, and then you have to be against someone who's just using game theory to make it game theory optimal. And if you understand the theories, you can do the same thing yourself, and then you're just both being raked off, and then you're done. If you're just playing someone who's just playing game theory optimal, it's not like if you're a skilled player, you're just going to sit there and donk off all your money. So it's not solved in the sense that any move you make, somebody's just going to counter you up. It's just somebody's kind of not looking at you like you're not even playing, basically just looking at their own hand, looking at probabilities. And I should call 20% of the time, raise 40% of the time, and just playing that type of way. So it's solved in the sense that if you just went up against a heads-up robot, you're not going to beat it. But you should recognize it pretty quickly what you're up against. And quite frankly, if you're playing heads up and if you're not sizing up your opponent pretty quickly, you're not going to win anyway, no matter who you're up against.
All right. We're talking to Rich Muni, Vice President of Poker Players Alliance. We're going to take a brief break for some commercials, and we'll be right back.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In August, the Summer Sizzling Seat Giveaway, every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 9 a.m. to 2 a.m. the following day, approximately 20 random players each hour will be awarded $100. Every Monday is Prime Monday, where Prime is the name of their sexy seniors 50 years of age and older. It includes a senior slot tournament, half-off dinner if you pay with points, $4 movies, and half-off bingo. Week 2 of the free video poker classes, Wednesday, August 9th, at noon, will cover the beginning strategies of two different games, namely 9-7 double bonus and 9-6 double-double bonus. The South Point's best versions of these games top out at about 99%, which is why we're not providing a more complete strategy. But there are several reasons to consider learning these games anyway. First, these games are popular, so if folks are going to play them, they might as well learn it right. Second, the two games are played very differently. They have very different returns for straights and flushes, and both of these cause a number of strategic differences from each other. What's more, we'll cover why the strategy is different, in a way that will help you figure out strategies for other games that come along. Third, they provide a foundation for later games in the semester. Fourth, if you wish to play the 100% versions of these games, which are still found for low stakes, only at a few Las Vegas local casinos that punish you for playing them, the strategies presented will work quite well. The class is in the Silverado Lounge, which is the first lounge you come to when you park in the garage. Everyone at least 21 years of age is welcome. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. You sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year. This allows you to get corrections on most of the games. The game of the week is Wheel Poker with Quick Quads. This is a 7 coins per line game. One of those extra coins was for the wheel poker aspect of the game, the other one for the quick quads aspect. When you receive a 4 of a kind or a quick quad, you spin the wheel, where the prizes range from 50 to 2,000. The wheel is random, but not equally weighted. The average spin comes out to be 157, approximately. Using this number, you can use the Wizard of Odds Video Poker Strategy Calculator to figure out a strategy and the game's return.
All right. Rich, when we left, you were talking about if you're playing heads up against a bot, you should be able to tell that pretty quickly. How would you tell that pretty quickly?
I didn't necessarily should be able to tell if you're against a bot. You should be able to tell if you can defeat that person pretty quickly. You should be able to size up your opponents. I know the common expression, I don't like, people use the word fish. I don't use the word fish because, I mean, I think recreational players are a very key part of the game. They should be respected. But if you're at a game, you know, you got like 7 or 8 players at the table, and if you haven't identified, you know, a couple of recreational players whom you think you can beat, then, you know, then you're the fish, you're the recreational player. You're the one who's there to donate, who's there to get a life experiencing at the table, and not there to win. If you're playing heads up against somebody, you should be able to decide if that person has various weaknesses, and if it looks like that person is playing an aggressive, tight aggressive game and seems to be calling and raising at a pretty good ratio, and you don't look like you're going to be ahead of this guy, you should be able to evaluate that this person is a skilled player. You might not be able to tell it's a bot. We kind of have to leave that to technology to make those determinations. And we do have the regulators are getting a lot better at being able to pick up when a bot is in the game. But in terms of, you know, just the individual, I don't think it matters. If the person can't pick up a bot, the person's not going to pick up if he or she is up against a superior player. Because this is, you're looking for the same sorts of things. And if you can't pick, if you haven't noticed that your player is weaker than you, and or if you're just kind of steaming because you're losing and you're kind of hoping just to get some big hands, heads up, you're not going to win either way.
You know, when I interviewed Chip Race, he said the same thing about cheating, that you may not know what someone's doing, but you pick up pretty quickly that, you know, it just seems like, you know, they're never calling when you have them beat and you're never seeing their hand, you know, when you're never winning a showdown, you know what I mean? So that makes sense to me that you should be able to pick up when you're playing against somebody you shouldn't be playing against anyway.
Yeah, precisely. Like I say, you probably won't know it's a bot, and you won't know if it's just a human being who's playing Game Theory Optimal, which is also possible, but you'll know that that person's better than you, or at least that you can't beat that person. And if you don't know that, then you're kind of missing out on a fundamental part of the skill of poker. Poker's a game of skill. Part of that skill is sizing up your opponent, especially heads up.
As you say, you play little poker.
Limit poker, not little poker.
Well, a little bit of limit poker.
I used to play a lot of limit poker. Yeah, and you're right, though. In the last couple of years, it's been challenging to get into good games.
But still being in the trenches, so to speak, probably, would that keep you grounded in your PPA work, or is that necessary?
I think I have so much, so much history playing the game, and I was working full time as an engineer, and I was getting in more than 40 hours a week playing for years and years and years. The background of playing is such that I'm so invested in actually playing and learning and developing the skills of the game. If I'm kind of backing off now, only because I'm not seeing the financial rewards of playing, my time is just better spent sizing up my opponents like Sheldon Adelson and these types of people. And especially in my full-time role as Poker Player Alliance Vice President, I'm able to stay a little more grounded in the fight part than if I were just trying to go head out to a local casino, wait for an hour to get a seat at a table at a 4-8 game with a $5 rake and, you know, tipping a couple bucks every pot and hoping I leave with anything more than my meal comp. But I do love the game, and it's fun to play. I do get out there, play when I can. A lot of times we have these tournaments at various events, sometimes charitable, sometimes not. And I do love the game, and it's very important to play. You're right. If I didn't play at all, it would be sad for me personally. And I get out there and play when there's a good opportunity.
The last time you were on, you said you did a weekly radio show. Are you still doing that?
I am. We've done it for 5 years now. I encourage everyone to tune in. And thanks, Bob, for bringing that up. You can check it out at ontiltradio.com. We air live Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I always try to have really good guests on, like Michelle Minton's going to be on. Well, I guess this is not airing live, so she was on. But on the record date, she's going to be on next Tuesday. But check it out. Because by the time you listen to this, it'll be on its podcast. And she is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. So it's like one of these think tanks that helps fight for libertarian causes. And she's very invested in the online poker issue. A couple weeks ago, we had Ron Paul's former legislative aide on the program. He's now the president of Ron Paul's new group, well, the group he founded right after he left Congress, which is a campaign for liberty. And they've just been tremendous in their support for poker, especially fighting the federal effort to ban it. So we have hard-hitting shows like that. We also have professional players, poker media, and I encourage everyone to check it out. So again, we always air live, and we're on most Tuesdays at 8 p.m. If we're not on, we have a rerun, but we don't typically have multi-segments. It's usually just one person, kind of like your format, Bob, and just kind of sit there and talk to that one person for an hour. So kind of learn everything about the issues that one person has to share.
And what is the podcast called?
The podcast is it's called Poker Advocacy with Rich Muni.
So it's definitely related to PPA.
Absolutely. It's solely, basically, they donated the program to us, so we run it commercial free. So we kind of have the airspace, and then they produce the podcast as well, and they put that on in an MP3 format. So you can also look us up on iTunes. Just search Poker Advocacy with Rich Muni, or just Poker Advocacy. It'll pop right up. And we put that online about 2 days after it airs. So I hope everyone will check it out. We've got hundreds of shows to listen to right now. You can go back 5 years and see how my predictions turned out.
At last week's World Series poker final main event, they announced this year's Hall of Fame inductees. They announced Phil Ivey, who just turned 40. And if you don't know who he is, you've been living under a rock. They also announced David Ulliott, who I was not that familiar with, but most poker players seem to think it's an excellent choice. Did you have an opinion on who should or should not make the Poker Hall of Fame?
I think it's an interesting body. They usually do a really good job of picking out people. They try to go beyond just the fame and the TV and get the people who've been really involved in the game. Phil Ivey goes well beyond just the fact that we all know who he is. He's really developed his game. I've talked to a number of really good players, and all I can think of with him, it just seems like he has a second nature to the game. It'd just be kind of a tough one to go heads up against or any kind of play against him. I just think he's so qualified for this. And the other inductees, they do a good job pulling the votes. I'm not, again, like you, I wasn't totally, incredibly familiar with this play. But looking at them as a whole, I've always thought they do a good job with what they do.
Did you have any thoughts on that, Richard?
No, I mean, I think Phil Ivey was just a shoe-in and probably 100%. I can't imagine someone voting not to put him in, or picking someone ahead of him.
Well, maybe the vice president at the Borgata, who still annoyed it.
Well, he doesn't get a vote, so.
Oh, okay.
it reminds me of when Shaq got MVP with, I think he only lost one vote. There was one vote the first year. I think Shaq won the MVP and.
Shaquille O'Neal.
Basketball. So, I mean, it was something like that. Shaq was so dominant, and Phil Ivey's been so dominant, and he had to wait till he was 40, and now he is, so of course he's in.
And I think the other thing with Ivey, you're kind of alluding to some of his other games with the, his play over at Borgata, and of course his play overseas at Baccarat. And it's very troubling when casinos let, somebody does a lawful move to play the game that they somehow think you can just get law enforcement to try to be game protection for you. It never used to be that way. Now, this is just the way it goes. It's going to be up for
law enforcement.
Thank you. I mean, obviously, it's up to what the laws are, but the very idea, he hasn't been charged with a crime for cheating, so it's just fascinating that you could actually go to court and when somebody beat your game following your own rules and just somehow say, well, it wasn't the spirit of the game, which was the London ruling, which I found to be bizarre. I wouldn't want to see that start working its way into poker, where somehow somebody loses a game and thinks they can take you to court because, you know, you did something they felt to be unethical. I mean, you play the game and you win or lose by the rules of the game.
Preach, brother. I wanted to ask you how you feel, and probably the PPA doesn't have an opinion on this, but how do you feel about there was a player this year at the World Series who had $600,000, over $600,000 in chips on the table, and they came and threw him out because he had been barred for playing blackjack a couple of years ago, and basically threw him out. And after he had $600,000 worth of chips.
Well, it's private property. Caesars has a right to do what they want to do. I wish they would have made the player knew he was barred from Caesars, presumably, so it seems like it would have been up to him to make some, enter into some discussions with Caesars about how, Caesars Corporation, of course, at the Rio, in terms of how they could make the play happen. I would like to see the player have been allowed to continue, but, like I said, they run it privately. Now, they might run into issues later on when other casinos try to make a case about this in the court of public opinion that it should, just be up to actual, who can play the game as opposed to what happened internally, because the person had a blackjack problem borrowing from the blackjack tables. But if the person was already trespassed, and I don't think there was a lot of dispute over the player understanding that he was trespassed, that private property is private property. Although I would like to see just everybody be able to play the game who's there to play, myself.
Well, I understand. But it seems to me that Caesars had an obligation to, you have to show ID when you enter the tournament, which he did. And, they allowed him to buy in and play for as long as he played. And once you have $600,000 in chips on the table, it seems, if you're going to throw him out, he should, in my mind, be entitled to some kind of compensation.
Well, sometimes people play under pseudonyms, and then you go to preserve your real name, and then you go in and you show up at the tournament with your real name, and surveillance may not have a mechanism to pick up on it at that time. I'm all in favor of people being able to play blackjack. I think blackjack is a game of skill as well, and if you're better than the casino, there shouldn't be a law against it, as there isn't. But at the same time, unfortunately, they can enforce private property rights. They can't in Atlantic City, so this player should probably maybe stick to tournaments out there because they're not allowed to physically bar him from the property, but that is the law in Nevada. And again, I'm all in favor of private property rights. I would prefer the casinos not bar people who weren't cheating or who weren't violent or drunken, who participated in drunken behaviors or other things like that. If all they did was participate in advantage play, I think the casino has a right to decide if they want to let people play those individual games. It would certainly be preferable, like I said, for the tournament, because it's not like solely the Rio's tournament. I like to think it belongs to the poker community, the whole WSOP. We all come together for it. But at the same time, it's a shame, but the player was aware, and I know he's aware of the risk. I mean, he's probably not saying, oh, Rio was unfair to me. He's probably saying, well, I gave it a try and they figured it out.
No, I think he's saying, I have a good lawsuit here.
Of course he is. But I mean, in real life, I don't think he can possibly say that he didn't understand the risks. Assuming there's no dispute that he was properly trespassing, like they warn you that don't come back or we'll have you arrested for trespassing. If he was properly what's called trespassed, and if he doesn't dispute it, which he probably will in the lawsuit, but I'm trying to explain this partially hypothetically, that's just the way it can go down. He might want to participate in some tournaments at places where he wasn't trespassed, and or talk to his legislators about the law in Nevada. I think that's going to be a tough one to change. Like if I were king of this state, I don't even live here, so it's kind of a presumption. And if I ran the, you know, if I get dictate to the casinos, you know, I would say kind of what I had said. If somebody's in the black book, if they're a known cheat, if they're a, you know, if they've been violent on the property, those types of things would be trespassable offense. It's not playing the game the way it was designed and just being able to beat the casino at their own game.
Yeah, I just, this is not the first guy this has happened to. There have been quite a few over the years, and I just think it's bad for poker.
I think it's bad for poker.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's bad for Caesars Entertainment as well, because they have no risk with a poker player, right? They're just taking a rake, so they're hurting themselves as well.
I think they get very little out of it. I mean, this player, once he exposed his real name, he's not going to show up at the poker tables, at the blackjack tables. If he does, then nobody will question trespassing him at that point, you know, so you kind of just keep an eye. They've got lots of people monitoring the blackjack tables. It's not like they wouldn't notice this person once they, what they call flyer him, but put out the information around the various pit bosses. That it's not like they wouldn't notice him over at the, you know, the Rio blackjack tables.
We wanted to ask Bob Nersessian about this question last time he was on, but Bob said the guy had approached him, Bob, and anything Bob had said was attorney-client privilege, so he wasn't willing to discuss it, at least at that point. If there becomes a settlement or a lawsuit or something like that, then possibly Bob can let us know some more details in the future.
Well, Bob's got his reputation precedes him. I mean, if I had to name one person somebody should talk to about this instance, just based on pure reputation, it would be him. No question. So I'm glad he's making contact with the right people to try to put, I mean, there are two sides to every story, and you have to be there to push your own issue, especially when you're out 600,000 in chips. So it's definitely wise for this player to be pushing his side of the story.
Well, also, what if I'm a player that this guy busted? You know, what if I was in the tournament and I lost to this guy and, you know, seems to me maybe I have a suit now too, right?
It would be interesting. They'd probably contend that he was a legitimate player and that you just lost to someone who's in the tournament, and they didn't actually kick him out of the tournament. They kicked him off the property, and then I guess he got blinded off. So that's probably how they'd phrase it.
Something for lawyers to argue about.
Not the Rio attorney, but yeah. I assume it would go something like that. But you're right. It would be interesting. I'd be pretty mad if, you know, I got busted out and then they go tap this guy on the shoulder, like, well, I'm kind of, you know, watching my chips go away. And then they tap him on the shoulder and escort him off the property. Like,
well, you know, we also had, I forgot his name, the guy who was in charge of all the publicity for the World Series before the World Series started.
Seth Polansky.
Seth, and we asked him, now this was before it ever started, and we asked him about this issue because it's happened in the past where, and he said, if you were just thrown out for playing blackjack, that shouldn't be a problem. Call us ahead of time, and we'll work out some kind of accommodation or whatever. And then here it comes again. So I don't know. Maybe they'll take enough heat over this over the various years that eventually they'll come up with a better policy about.
So is this guy's problem for not listening to our radio show, so he didn't
exactly
know that?
Should have called Seth. Seth's a good guy. I don't know how he is on this type of issue, but it sounded like
he
offered up
a
pretty reasonable.
But that doesn't mean that his bosses or the people up above, you know, are as reasonable as Seth.
Precisely. But if anybody in the property gave him the go ahead, I think he'd be golden to stay there, especially after he paid his entry fee, got buy-in from anybody who said they had authority to speak for Caesars Entertainment. I don't think Rio would be inclined to kick him out at that point. They'd probably just let it go. But at the same time, you have to think, if somebody's playing under an assumed identity, really, really high stakes, got ejected from the property, they're going to pick up the phone and, yeah, I was playing as Joe Schmo, and my real name is this and this, and I want you to go ahead and record that with my real name for me, and I wanted to see if it would be okay if I can play. I can understand someone hoping to come in under the radar.
Very good. We've been talking to Richard Muni of Poker Player Alliance. Thank you very much, Rich.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.